Hello, this is Jason Isaacs, a.k.a.
Captain Gabriel Lorca from Star Trek Discovery,
and you're listening to Subspace Transmissions.
We traveled into the future.
930 years.
A one-way trip. No going back.
Order to Discovery, come in.
Discovery, do you copy?
You have reached year 3188.
Is there life here? Anywhere?
Multiple life signs detected.
Yes! Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the very, very futuristic bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, and he's done being reflexively supportive.
And we're here this week to talk about the latest episode of Star Wars Discovery, The New Hope Is You.
Okay. I appreciate that one. Don't remember, it's episode one.
Right, yes, episode one.
Cam, for those that might be confused, what exactly are we doing today?
We're going to tackle the premiere of season three Discovery, and the episode is actually called That Hope Is You, Part One. But
is there going to be a scene in episode two where they say That Hope Is You again, Michael Burnham? Is that why it's only part one? Okay. I'm sorry. I interrupted you there. What was that?
This is a total tangent right off the start of the show, but I was looking at IMDb for the episode titles, and it's like, there's no part two.
Really? What is next week's?
Okay. So I've seen two different things. One's Far From Home and something, I think the other one is like Fear Begets You or something like that. I can't remember what the second one was, but everything I could see online did not list a That Hope Is You part two. So I'm fascinated if that's the case. Again, this is all speculative because I don't know that they've officially announced any titles, but that would be amazing if there was only a part one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, maybe the series finale will be part two.
Not from what I've seen. So I don't know.
What do you mean not from what you've seen?
Well, they had the titles for all the episodes. So I don't know.
Up into the series finale? Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, I don't know if it was something
Cam,
that leaked
do you know
what
a series finale is?
Oh, series. Sorry, I thought you said season finale. Oh, series finale. That would be amazing. Look, I'm so caught up with the Star Warsian excitement of it all that I just totally didn't hear you.
Okay, well, let's jump into it because I want to skip the first like 45 minutes of this episode. I want to get to what I think is the crux of this episode, and maybe it is that Hope Is You speech that we get from Mr. Sahil. This is actually what I've been waiting for, you know, for I guess what, like 18 months now, is for the show to actually kind of find itself, have a raison d'etre after all this while, because all we've been watching for like two seasons is a lot of like story beats unfold, you know, a story beat upon a story beat, rather than like fully, you know, realized stories. And so I was excited by what we saw in the last 5 minutes. Everything leaning up to that, I've complained about before. I'm not all that invested in like these Star Trek action sequences. I can be impressed by some of the stuff that they do, but if I'm watching Michael Burnham just vaporize space aliens for like 7 minutes straight, I get a little bored.
There was a few things that definitely kind of jumped out to me. I mean, everything to do with like the character of Book who shows up, I look forward to talking about him in a few minutes, but you know, having the view screen activate and basically Greedo / Jabba the Hutt being like, I'll get you for stealing my cargo. I'm like, wow, okay, this is very familiar. And then, yeah, all the action was very Star Warsy. I mean, it felt in a lot of ways like the kind of thing we saw in Star Wars The Force Awakens. And so I kind of just was like, okay, like the Iceland cinematography looks beautiful, but I don't know that like I've ever, when I look at Star Trek Discovery, been like, the best thing about the show is the phaser battles. I was going to say battles, but that ship battle at the end of season two was so amazing that I don't want to besmirch it. But no, that final scene that you're talking about was my favorite, you know, bit of the episode for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's get into book, because I think a lot of this episode, it had a couple things that it needed to do. A, it had to place Burnham in the 32nd century, or I believe it is. Mm-hmm. I think they said it's 3188 right now. They had to place her in this new setting, and they had to introduce this new main character, played by one David Ajala. Cam, he's a rogue with a heart of gold. Is that like another Star Wars illusion yet again for this episode?
I mean, this character was very Han Solo through the majority of it. I guess until he became Luke Skywalker communing with the Force.
Yeah. Okay. I am incredibly confused. Is Book a human?
I'm not sure about that either.
His name is Cleveland Booker. Is that a space alien name?
It's clearly from Saturn.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Yeah. So he's a Saturnian?
That's right. Clearly. I'm surprised you missed that, Tyler. That's very classic Saturnian name.
Okay. So he has a human name. He looks human, but he has special powers.
Okay. So I was very confused, because when he's doing this praying technique, and his forehead is lighting up, I thought it was some sort of technology that we don't understand, because it's, again, 3188. But I don't know. When that plant came up from the ground, the healing plant, I just was like, this feels like magic. We've definitely gone into the magic realm here.
Well, he was talking about his gene pool and how they're full of killers and poachers. And every once in a while, someone like him springs up and he's kind of rejected from his society. I'm confused as to what he is exactly.
Well, could this be like a human colony somewhere in the galaxy that just developed all their own customs and became their own thing over the many years since they left Earth?
I don't think evolution quite works that way, though.
But do you think it was evolution, or do you think it was some sort of technology we don't understand?
I got the sense that he has superpowers, and it wasn't necessarily technology, because he said specifically his gene pool. He made reference to his gene pool. But he has he looks like a human, he has a human name, but he also has superpowers. And he has to do that with, like, praying. I notice a lot in that kind of the Kurtzman era, like the spirituality side of Star Trek. Gene Roddenberry was the humanist. It was kind of made clear that the spirituality side of things, it had to do with more primitive beings worshiping superior aliens. Even made clear with the Bajorans, who are a very spiritual society, that it didn't take away the fact that despite the prophets being aliens, they could still worship them, and it was treated respectfully. But with the Kurtzman stuff, it feels as if their response is, well, you never know. Maybe it is has to do with God. And I'm just kind of like, that's kind of missing the point of what Roddenberry is trying to say with humanism, in which all the great feats that have been accomplished by man, it's not because of some sort of gods. It's because of humans' own ingenuity there. And so I just, when we have Book praying and sprouting plants with healing powers, I'm just kind of scratching my head about what the message is behind this.
Yeah, because we get that this character is a conservationist ultimately by the end of the episode. I'm like, okay, that's an angle to take on this character. I don't know that it is as interesting as sort of the roguish character, but I'm willing to go with this. And I do wonder, though, how much of just these teases we're seeing of elements like this are going to be explained, say, even in the next episode, where we understand where this character is exactly coming from. Because I feel like still at this point, they're shrouding a lot of him in mystery.
I have to say, it's kind of a cynical move, I think, on the part of the writers, where they set him up to be this real jerk that you can't trust. Mm-hmm. But then in the end, you're obligated to like him as a viewer because he loves animals. And it's just like, oh, how daring for the writers to make this guy love animals so much.
And yet I was sort of on board, because it felt like one of the more Star Trek-y elements of the episode, where that was the angle of the character versus just being this, you know, Han Solo figure. Or Outrageous Okona, perhaps.
I get that. I just kind of find it like, okay, do you notice like a lot of people that really love animals, they don't really like humans that much?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just wonder if that's his thing. Like, he's willing to let Burnham die so that he could save a queen worm whale or something like that. Molly, the queen.
the trans worm, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. The trans. What is a trans worm, by the way?
I don't know. I have no idea.
I have no idea either.
It reminded me of something from Starship Troopers.
Okay. I'm always fascinated by the people that they value the life of animals, but humans. Yeah, a human gets murdered. Oh well, that's kind of what their reaction is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I know people like this, so you know, yeah. it's a thing.
Going back to people getting murdered, though, have we ever seen like Burnham just sit there and fire phasers until people vaporize? Like she probably killed what, like 10, 12 people in this episode?
Yeah, I thought that was weird. When you had her and Book on the run from these Andorians and a few other alien species in there and just like blasting them into like dust, I kind of was like, oh, this is kind of weird. Like, you always got the sense, generally, violence was a last resort. And I know Discovery has definitely had a lot of martial arts fights and various, you know, combat throughout the series, but it never felt like kind of just shooting up cannon fodder.
Yeah.
Like, it felt like you would get a fight with, say, like Cole or something where Cole is killed. You know, fights with Giorgio, fights with Takuvma, things like that. Felt very character specific versus just like blowing away, just like, again, cannon fodder. You know, like the closest thing you could say is like drone ships in the Section 31 battle, in the space battle. But again, that's drone ships. That's very different.
Could you imagine an episode of Next Gen where it's just like Picard and Riker standing by a rock and then vaporizing people for 7 minutes straight?
And not only that, people who, I mean, you could understand them getting in a phaser fight, say, with, you know, the Borg or the Romulans over a specific mission. These people are just like, you know, they may not be the most wonderful, you know, characters in the galaxy, but they aren't tied to a specific enemy plot or anything. They just are basically like security goons at like a, you know, I don't know, trading station.
Are we supposed to hate them? Are they like Nazis or something? I didn't get that sense.
No, because they were portrayed kind of comedic. The two we saw doing the, you know, the whatever, the truth drug on Burnham. It's not like those two are portrayed as like these like super evil, you know, dudes.
But my only rationalization, though, is Burnham was still on that truth serum, so she was under the influence of drugs, but she, by the end of the episode, it's not like as if she had to come to grips with like killing like a dozen people in the course of a few minutes.
Yeah, it was weird. I definitely felt it was weird. It felt a little tonally off, and I was writing my notes, like it reminded me of kind of the phaser shootout at the end of 2009, Star Trek 2009 film that J.J. Abrams did, where you were on the Romulan ship. But that's, again, very different. That's tied to a specific Romulan plot versus what this is.
Why did Book take Burnham along with him at the in the transporter beam to get out of the mercantile facility?
You know, at this point, I was actually also making notes that this was like a buddy action movie where the two of them hate each other but keep dragging each other along.
But why?
I don't have a good plot specific reason for you.
I've watched this episode twice and I was confused both times why he suddenly had, after leaving her in the vault to be interrogated and tortured or whatever, and then he's getting shot at, he decides to bring her with him for, and I was just like, why? Why is he doing that all this? Wouldn't it be easier for him to just make a solo escape?
Yeah. Was it? Well, they have that moment too, where they're both, you know, have phasers trained on them and then they like do the nod back and forth and then take them down just before that whole sequence. So I guess they're on the same page now, I guess.
That's all it was. It was, he's getting beaten up. Burnham just nods her head and then they all start fighting everybody. And I guess, I don't know, maybe he thinks he needs to transport away. And so he has two people shooting during the chase. I don't know. I was just, it seemed like a very strange turn for the character that was not really explained by anything that happened other than, well, we need to get Burnham onto Book's ship somehow.
I knew things were going to go kind of weird in that regard, though, when, like, the second they meet, they're engaging in, like, a martial arts fight. I was like, oh, yeah, I know where we're going. And then a lot of the comedy seemed to be Burnham punching him in the face throughout the episode. I'm like, oh, yeah, classic Burnham, always punching people in the face.
Well, okay, Cam, Book's explanation for, like, jumping off the cliff so they could transport into water is, like, their scanners can't track them in water. Why not?
Tyler. Water doesn't work with scanners. You should know this. This is classic Star Trek. That's in the making of Star Trek that Gene Roddenberry wrote in 1965 or 66 or whatever.
You're right. You're right. I feel so dumb now. I don't know. Okay, so the thing is, I love the last 5 minutes of this episode. I just everything leading up to it, like it had some moments that I like, but it is my continued issue that I have with, like, say, Discovery or Star Trek Picard. I keep ask myself, why is this even happening? And the writers never explain why things are happening. Things just happen. And it's, to me, you're relying more on plot points to drive characters from point A to point B rather than characters driving the plots. So it's more of, I prefer the character journeys and the character decisions driving the plot rather than the plot driving where the characters go.
I think it's also tough that you can tell, like, Kurtzman is taking a page from the Star Wars Force Awakens book. Like, it feels a lot like the way J.J. Abrams directed sequences in that movie, where characters are always running, you know, they're kind of bouncing off each other while action's happening. It felt like they wanted to do that here. Instead of having this kind of depressing sequence of Burnham landing and being alone, they wanted to turn it in kind of this action buddy kind of movie or kind of episode. But at the same time, we know the Burnham character and we know the story she's been going through for the last two seasons. It felt weird. It just felt really weird when you consider kind of the heaviness of this journey she's just taken to kind of be doing this sort of stuff. And I'm also, it's weird because I'm really, like, battling with myself over this, because on one hand, I was glad to see they weren't going all dark and grim and miserable, which Discovery can sometimes do, and Picard did as well, which I don't think suits the show. But at the same time, I'm not sure that going with this kind of just, kind of pumped up action story really worked in service of the story of what this series is.
Yeah, and you said something I want to seize on. You said a moment ago, we know the Burnham character. And I've been thinking about that. Like, I'm like, do we know the Burnham character? Because I remember back when we did our season one review, I said that Burnham was probably my favorite character of the show. And that was at the time. But you go back and you watch that season again, you watch season two, and I'm like, this character has changed quite a bit from how she was first introduced. In that, for the first half, I tried to narrow down when her character began to really change. But for the first half of season one, she was more of this aloof sort of character. I think that it played very well to SMG's strengths. And then I figured out, like, by the time you get into the Ash-Tyler romance, she's starting to loosen up. But it's also the stuff where she starts, like, crying every couple episodes again and again. And I just did not find it as thrilling to watch as I maybe did in the first half of season one. I really liked her character in the first half of season one. I think that carried a lot of momentum through to the end of that season. When I watch an entire episode of Discovery and she is the one and only main character being featured other than the new character Book, I just don't know if that plays to Discovery's strengths anymore, because Burnham at this point, she's no longer my favorite character on the show. Like, I'm much more interested in what, you know, Tilly or Saru or even evil Mir Georgiou is going to do. And I was not a Georgiou fan, the Mir version when she was first introduced either.
You mentioned the Burnham crying in a lot of episodes, and she does in this episode as well. I think the thing is, like, from what, you know, I've seen of Sinequa Martin Green in person at these conventions, she's a very sincere person who you can tell is very empathic towards other people. And I think at a certain point, you know, they write the characters based on the actors, and I feel like they seized on what her actual qualities were and are working that into the character, where she's someone who feels a lot. And I think there's issues of, you know, kind of the banging the same nail over and over again with that character that they keep falling back on. But I think that what they're trying to do is play to her strengths in terms of these kind of emotional moments. But, you know, then at the same time, you get like a comedy sequence and I go, oh, maybe comedy isn't her thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It does. You are right, though, like in that Burnham has changed a lot. I am really just going to be fascinated when we finish this complete series, if it feels like there was a cohesive arc to this character's journey.
I get the sense that there will be, you know, but mm-hmm. I want to seize on something, though, in that the funniest line in this entire episode is when she and Book are suddenly in that firefight and she exclaims, "I am done being reflexively supportive." Like, I thought that was a great commentary on the character, kind of meta commentary on the show itself. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, if you go to episode one, she's not a reflexively supportive character in any way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's very accurate, yeah.
It's like the character is fundamentally not the same character that we were introduced to, and I was much more invested in that character, and I realized that there has to be an arc, but the thing is, it seems like such a sudden change for the character, and I can't, for a doofus like Ash Tyler to be the one to bring about that change, I'm just like, okay, I don't know if it's earned.
I think they also want this character to be quote unquote fun for the audience to spend a lot of time with.
Yes.
I mean, she's the central character guiding the show. She gets, you know, here a whole episode to herself. And I wonder if they looked at that character who was set up initially on Discovery and said it would be very difficult for audiences to have fun with this character for a full hour. And you can look at Picard, and I think they found ways to have a character who was very regal and serious, but also fun. I feel like with her, they sometimes push her too far in a fun direction. It doesn't feel like they're finding a natural balance between what we kind of saw early on and what we maybe get now.
I think Patrick Stewart and SMG are different kinds of actors, and I think they realize you can't play them as the same thing. I think it'd be tough, as you say, if your main character is a super aloof sort of character who's just miserable about the fact that she started a war or whatever. That's not going to be fun to watch for, you know, 5, 6, 7 seasons. I get why they had to change the character, but I have to wonder, like, how I'm not as invested in Burnham anymore as I am now the supporting cast at this point.
Right. I did think she was really good, though, in moments where she's landed on this planet and she's, you know, having to convince herself to keep going. Like, I like the survival element of this episode. It's elements of those of Burnham that I really enjoy seeing more versus like that gas sequence. I wrote a note where I just went,
What about the truth serum?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That didn't really work for me. The other moment that did not work for me is that she scans for life and she finds evidence of life. And so she knows that her mission was a success and she starts hooting and hollering.
That was really weird.
That made me cringe. I was just like, okay.
That was like a season one Geordi going like, woo-wee.
It was. The other thing is, okay, you know, she takes this helmet off of her spacesuit and she starts spewing out perfectly clear water.
Yeah, that was weird.
Where did that come from?
Well, I assumed initially she was like throwing up because of the trip, but the fact it was clear water.
I was confused because the thing, it wasn't puke. And I also like she had actually had her mouth open right as she was opening the helmet. So it's like, where did the water come from? Where did this crystal clear water come from?
Okay. Did they want to have her throwing up to show kind of the trauma of this trip, but they felt like vomit would be too gross?
I think so. I think they chickened out.
Yeah, I think so too. That makes complete sense to me. Yeah.
Cam, we are in the 32nd century now. We have a lot of world building to do. I'm intrigued by, you know, things, how, you know, Burnham is a little confused why, you know, the Orions and the Andorians are now teaming up. Look, the world has changed. Remember she says it's impossible when told that the Federation has collapsed. I don't know, if I went ahead 1,000 years, and somebody told me that, say, Canada has collapsed, I could go, yeah, I believe it.
Yeah, I guess they just really believe in the Federation that much that it's going to be eternal. I don't know. Nothing's eternal, so I don't think it's that crazy.
Well, Cam, she says that the Federation is a vision, and everyone who believes in it is the Federation. What is that vision, Cam?
Yes, we are Starfleet.
We have values. We promote those values. Values are good. They need to spell it out. Like, they need to spell out why. Like, I think they said it like maybe a season ago. We're like, yes, we believe in equality. I'm like, wow, that's a very daring and bold choice to take in this time. You know, like, they really need to spell it out more explicitly. And the thing is, like, Gene Roddenberry espoused those very, very liberal values, and I think they just they might be a little too frightened in this climate to like come out and just be honest about it, though. But when you have the vague references to the importance of the Federation and its vision, I don't know, it's tough to be invested in what the characters are even saying if they don't let us know if they don't illustrate it somehow.
I think a lot of the heavy work there is done by the audience, you know, a lot of the fans who obviously know how important the Federation is and what it means. So they bring that over. I think they're doing more of a disservice to people that this is their first Star Trek show, because I don't think it's explaining to them why it's important.
Exactly. Yeah. The other thing, okay, so Book seems to be not a history buff, but I don't know. Let's say I asked you, hey, Cam, does the USSR still exist?
Right, no.
No, it doesn't? Okay, why not?
I don't remember the reasons why.
Okay, well, maybe
I'm not a history buff. You are. You are a history major. I'm not.
I'm just saying. Like, I would have thought that
it's tied to the Cold War. I know that the end of the Cold War, right? The Berlin Wall.
Well, it has more to do with like kind of the collapse of the economy, and really it stemmed from the Solidarity movement that was going on in Poland at the time. And you could argue that the Pope was actually had much more to do with the collapse of the Soviet Union than anything else. But essentially what you have is that the Soviet Union was pursuing kind of this non-interference and these reform policies. It was no longer going to take military intervention if some of its satellite countries or satellite states were going to have their own revolutions. And so, but essentially I summed it up in about 30 seconds. Book mm-hmm. just kind of shrugged. He's just like, I don't know, Federation, eh. He's just like, oh, okay. Like, I don't know. I thought it would have been important enough for like him to at least have a bit of knowledge, but all he knows is like, it collapsed 100 to 120 years ago before he was born.
They also brought up the burn. And he's like, well, it's when all the dilithium exploded. They're like, how'd that happen? He's like, I don't know.
I know. He's not a history buff here. Did you have any trouble with David Ajala's accent?
No, I didn't actually.
Okay. I had the subtitles on the second time I watched this one, and I understood everything perfectly. But the first time, I was like, wait, what is he saying? Like, I don't know. Like, he's from London or something. Maybe it's one of those, it's not a Cockney accent. Or anything like that, but it's one of those accents where I stumbled a couple times and I was wondering, like, am I missing some important information here?
Right. No, I didn't have that problem. I mean, I have had other movies or TV shows where I have had that problem, but not with him, no.
Okay. Okay. But Cam, they've set up the burn as this season's mystery.
Yes.
Are we going to get an answer to this in the next episode, or are they going to drag it out for another 13 or another 12 episodes moving forward?
Tyler, when they said that there was this event, they don't know what it was, but it destroyed everything. I was just like, oh no, oh no. This season's going to resolve with them having to go back to stop the burn, isn't it? Like, is that what's going to happen? Please, God, don't let me be right on this.
I don't think so. I think maybe... I think this season is going to be built around trying to reverse the impacts of the burn. You know,
I hope so.
It's going to be right. About them trying to figure out what happened, and then see if they can get, you know, planets make interstellar travel much easier, get communication going on, reconnect people in ways, because even the acting communications chief Sahil was saying that he only has the ability to do I think a 30 sector radius So I think that means that like communication isn't what it used to be. Okay, can I do a little bit of back of the napkin math for you with regards to light years and sectors and all that?
Go for it.
Okay, so he said that there are two ships in a 600 light year radius. He only has the ability to track a 30 sector radius. So then we'd have to assume that there are 20 cubic light years per sector. So if sector 001, it's like a 20 light year radius. That means like it's not only Earth, and I'm bringing up the whole like best of both worlds establishment that Earth is sector 001. It's not only Earth. It'd be planets like, say, Vulcan, I think, would be included in like sector 001, like other ones that are close to Earth. So that's just the thing that I noticed with him laying out the math on us like that.
Oh, that's interesting. And it would make a lot of sense, you know, if you're including planets like well-known planets like Vulcan, to have episodes where we have Burnham go to Vulcan and we can revisit it this many years later and kind of establish their status quo, like kind of start off with some of the places we recognize, as opposed to what Star Trek so often is of, we're going out to planets, you know, we've never seen before.
I think that'd be great, but she's obviously going to have to get on the Discovery somehow, and they're going to have to use a spore drive, even though they've been told that the spore drive is destroying that the mycelial network and all that, because if dilithium is not usable or if it's scarce and it can't be replenished, although Queen Poe from Runaway, the short trek, she apparently invented a way to replenish dilithium. I don't know. But it makes me think that we're going to get a lot more spore drive action moving forward. The other thing I was wondering about, like if dilithium replenishment is so difficult, that book was reduced to selling Burnham's antiques at the mercantile station. Why is it that he agreed to take her to this Federation outpost that is a bit of a courier waypoint of sorts?
Because it would lead to a great twist where he would screw her over in that moment.
Ah, okay, okay. Again, I kept asking myself, like, why is, what's motivating Book's decisions, like, other than he loves animals?
Right, yeah, yeah. I had a question. Am I remembering wrong, but don't, like, the Romulans, they, in, like, say, the 24th century, they didn't use dilithium, they used something else?
Yes, they used quantum singularity to power their warp cores, as established.
That's right.
Yeah, I believe that was established in the episode Timescape from TNG.
So what's going on there?
So, well, I guess we can guess that the collapse of the Romulan Star Empire post JJ movies, we're seeing that with Picard. Maybe those quantum singularity powered starships just weren't a thing by the time the burn happened anymore. I don't know.
Right. You know, you would think they would have had different ways of running ships that many hundreds of years later. That kind of is a surprise to me.
Yeah, I mean, we saw some hints of it during the Journey of Voyager, you know, about like people would have like little spacebound portals, or they would mm-hmm. fold space through specific devices. It's not impossible, but it seems as if, I don't know, it's like if we were told, yeah, we can't drive anywhere anymore, you're like, okay, well, we still have planes and boats, but it just means like the way that we get around much more easily, that if that's gone, then yeah, we're probably going to be affected by the way that we travel moving forward in
For
a way
sure.
that's very difficult.
I was going to say, speaking of traveling, what did you think of now just having the portable, you know, transporting badges or whatever?
You mean the way that Star Trek Into Darkness kind of ruined space travel for us with Khan's invention?
Yes.
I'll justify it in my head as they might just have limited range, and as Book established, he has to recharge after a certain bit. It didn't seem as if they left planet Iceland, aka I think they called it Heum or something like that. So mm-hmm. I don't think it'll take you from one planet to the other. You have to rely on one Khan Noonien-Sung for that.
I think they have to build in limitations to it. It makes sense in terms of the evolution of Star Trek technology. And it's one of those problems of Star Trek technology is already pretty amazing. And if you take it too much further, it becomes invincible powers, basically, that people have all the time. And so I think you build in limitations the way you do, you know, with, say, Spider-Man, where he's going to run out of web shooter fluid at a certain point. I think they have to do that with these portable transporters as well.
Yeah, I would get a little annoyed if they're just kind of the go-to Deus Ex Machina to get out of every sort of sticky situation.
Nice.
I'm not trying to out you, Cam, but just so listeners know, you probably jumped out of your seat because that's your password as well, right?
I was confused. I think you were making a double joke there with both the reference to the episode as well as web fluid in Spider-Man.
I'm on so many different levels that
that's only, right.
Yeah. But that sequence, though, when we have Queen Molly eat everybody, I did like the fact that when she took a bite out of the Andorians, there was some blue blood splatter on the lens of the camera, which I was just like, oh, okay, that was clever.
That was great. I was wondering, was that a Raiders of the Lost Ark reference? Where they let her out of the pod, and then he's like, close your eyes, don't look. And all the ones that look die? That felt very end of Raiders of the Lost Ark to me.
I don't know if it's a direct reference. I won't throw it out. The thing is, the reason I'm skeptical, because it wasn't like such a an obvious reference, you know? Like, I think they would have really telegraphed it if that's what they were going for.
Yeah, it was so similar that I thought, oh, I wonder, because obviously Kurtzman, that, you know, that group, they really, there tends to be the things they reference are pretty popular mainstream, you know, blockbusters and things like that. So it wouldn't have shocked me if that was maybe a little bit of the thinking.
Yeah. The aliens that we saw, familiar faces, but was there mm-hmm. something going on with the makeup in like, the second Andorian, not the one who is originally at the gate, but the one that was interrogating Burnham, his makeup looked like a Halloween mask or something.
Now, you're saying the Andorian. I was just staring at the Orion, and I'm like, why does that green paint look so weird?
It looked very sort of weirdly reflective, and none of the Andorians' antennae moved at all. They mm-hmm. were all static, and we even had like a Tellarite featured in the Queen Molly sequence. And it looked as if his beard was like made out of like the bristles from like a brush or something like that. And they looked pasted on his face. I'm just like, did they have they could only afford like the B team in Iceland to fly in or something like that?
Well, this looked like a very expensive episode. So maybe there was some cost cutting. Although when it comes to makeup looking iffy, I tend to put that more on the lighting. Well, and the cinematography yeah. than I do the makeup.
But the reason I was so confused, though, is because the makeup for the Tellarites on Picard and on Discovery and for the Andorians as well, they've all previously looked exceptional. And I was just like mm-hmm. weirded out by how weirdly like the light was reflecting off of their faces. And it looked fake.
Yeah, and I mean, I just found that with the Orion, that the guy who was interrogating her, the Orion there, like, I just was staring at that makeup going like, this looks weird. This doesn't look like what we normally see in Orion makeup.
Yeah. Kim, establishing this universe, books, ship, I dig it. It looks like the interior is like a cool bachelor pad. I can believe that the ship design, the exterior, is something from this era. I also just like how, if we look at how furniture operates or how consoles operate, they've gone beyond even holographic technology, and it's kind of like almost, it looks like Terminator Genesis-esque sort of like movements with regards to how they're using electromagnets to split apart the Terminator in that one, but it's still kind of cool here. I like the ingenuity that the production team is using for this now.
I would love it if they were like, that wasn't a Raiders of the Lost Ark reference, but that was a Terminator Genesis reference.
yes. What do you think of how they've established the look of the 32nd century?
I think they did a really good job in that. I liked when you had scenes, for example, of Burnham walking around bookship, showing the technology. It felt like an evolution of what we'd seen. It had a more futuristic look. It was doing that classic nanoprobe kind of thing that we see in, you know, the Marvel movies do it now. It's kind of the go-to futuristic concept now. But it felt like it was an evolution of what we'd seen in the past of Star Trek. It didn't feel like suddenly we've been dropped in a world where everything is magic.
I just remember that episode, Relativity from Star Trek Voyager, in which I think it's 7 of 9 has to infiltrate the 29th century ship from the Federation, the USS Relativity. And you look at their consoles, and their consoles all look like they're ripped straight out of the 24th century. I'm just like, that's not, like, come on, guys. Like, do a little better than that, right?
Yeah. Do you have a problem, though, with when you look at, you know, the original Star Trek, when you look at TNG, any of the other ones, when you see the technology in that world, it feels very tactile. It feels like you could practically feel it when you look at it. But when I look at a lot of the technology here, it's kind of like I can't really imagine what that feels like. You know what I mean?
Oh, I know what you're saying. And maybe that kind of hangout factor, it kind of dissipates because like it almost becomes meaningless to your eyes to a certain degree.
Yeah. And I don't know what the way around it is, because obviously when they're jumping this far into the future, they want to show, they want to basically be able to tackle Star Trek technology in a way we've never seen before and make it look more advanced than what we've seen in, you know, not just the Berman era, but also the kind of updated aesthetics of Picard and what have you. But I have a hard time looking at characters, you know, moving these controls and stuff and going like, I know what that would be like.
Yeah. Yeah. I good luck to whoever has to make fan props for this technology.
I wonder if they're going to keep, like, a big part of the strength of keeping the Discovery ship is that we don't have that effect. We still are going to have characters operating a ship and technology we understand, even if it is updated throughout the series.
It'll be cool to see some, like, integrations into the Discovery ship as well.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I'm curious if we actually see some of the Discovery characters who have, like, implants, like, lose them over the course of the show because of updated technology. Like, Detmer, for example.
Oh, Arium, you should not have sacrificed yourself so soon.
Yeah, no kidding.
One of the things that this episode kind of reminded me of, in the closing moments, you know, they were saying, like, well, yes, you made it through that wormhole, Burnham, but it might be up to 1,000 years before your ship comes through. Cam, do you think it's going to be 1,000 years until we see the USS Discovery again?
No, I laughed about that. But you know what? It is classic Star Trek in the sense you have, you know, at the end of DS9, Sisko saying, I may be back tomorrow. I may be back yesterday. You know, like playing with this sort of time travel. When could they be back? Thing has been done before. Also in the 2009 film with Nero versus Spock coming through the black hole at different points in time. So I appreciated it in that Star Trek context, but no, I don't think it's going to be that much longer.
Do you think it'll be episode 2?
I was asking myself that question too. It seems like it would be a lot to stretch it to like episode 3, doesn't it?
At the very least, I think she would find the Discovery at the very end of episode 2.
Do you think we could get a whole episode just built around Discovery?
That would be fun. I'd be down for that. Look, My biggest complaint about this one is I think it's a lot to hang on the shoulders of Burnham if you have an entire episode centered on her. And that's for me personally. She's not my favorite character anymore to watch. So if you have way more of the main cast for an entire episode, maybe explaining their own journey towards meeting Burnham, I would love to catch up, you know, with Stamets and Tilly and Saru and everybody.
Yeah, and I think it also it would work better if you just have Burnham as your, you know, series lead showing up on this in this episode. If you just have more characters to spend time with throughout the episode, you only get Book. I mean, other than that, and you also, of course, get Sahil, who shows up really at the very end. Yes, he's in the pre-credits, but mostly just at the end. There's not a lot of other characters who really pop out. And I think maybe if you'd had maybe one or two more in there who aren't necessarily going to be recurring characters or anything, but at least characters that jump off the screen a little bit, that would have made it a little bit of an easier transition.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. But you don't think Cosmo, the bird merchant or whatever, the one who is chasing after Book at the beginning, he's not the pop-out character of the season now that he's vaporized?
Yeah, I would have probably tried to do a little bit more with him. No, you don't need to do a lot, but just make him a little more distinct as a character.
Has David Ajala ever watched Star Trek before, Cam?
I mean, I don't expect a lot of actors who work in Star Trek to have watched Star Trek. Why do you ask?
Do you think maybe the script coordinator should have kind of helped him out with the pronunciation of words like tricorder or temporal? Because he was saying tricorder. We need to get your tricorder over here. And he also said, yes, since the temporal wars. That jumped out to me.
Sabotage. Sabotage.
he's emulating a Shatner right there. That's what he was trying to do.
I was okay with it. I was just happy to hear reference to the temporal war. That kind of made me smile.
Well, I'm curious about this. Like, are they trying to... Okay, so they say that time travel technology has been banned ever since the end of the temporal Cold War, or he called it the temporal wars. So
yeah,
I'm assuming it's one and the same thing there. So that would put, I think Daniels was coming from, was it the 29th century? I think, or was the,
I think it was 29th. Yes.
Yeah. And so if the Federation collapsed, after the burn, and the Federation tried to hang on for a while after the burn, I think the timing lines up with like the time travel technology is banned, and then the burn happens soon after. Does that kind of line up with what you took away from this episode?
So I had a note. It seems like the burn happened around 3060-ish, somewhere in there, like, you know, give or take a handful of years.
Where do you get that from?
Because he drops it happening like 120 years ago or something like that. He does mention that.
I thought he said that's when the Federation disappeared.
I thought that's when he was talking about the burn. Okay. That's what I had there written down in that whole section of my notes talking about the burn.
Okay.
It's right after he gives the description of what happened, you know, with the whole dilithium going boom.
Then when did the Federation collapse?
That's an excellent question. That I don't have a point written down for.
Because that would sound as if the Federation only collapsed based on what he was saying. Like they tried to hang on for a couple generations, right? After the burn?
Yeah.
So that would tell me that the Federation collapsed 10 years ago and he doesn't know anything about it. I'm pretty sure he said it was the Federation. Look, I could totally be wrong. I'm not going to like bet you $1 million, but I thought he was referencing the Federation collapsing 100 to 120 years ago. And it was after the burn had already happened and the Federation tried to hang on for a couple generations, but they just couldn't after the burn.
We'll have to go back to the tape on that one for next week.
For sure. But wouldn't that make more sense though?
Yeah.
Then like the Federation collapsing like 10 years ago and Book knows nothing of it.
Well, that would be incredibly strange. Agreed, 100%, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I think we'll have to go back to the tape or whatever. But like, I think it lines up. The burn happens around the same time that the temporal wars end. I just wonder if this is one last shot in that war, I don't know, by those scary Nazi aliens from Stormfront or maybe the Suliban or I don't know. I just wonder if that was one last thing to try to like bring about the collapse of the Federation. And that's what they did as part of their final volley of weaponry or something.
Tyler, are we finally going to find out the identity of Shadow Man from, you know, the Phantom Menace character from Enterprise?
If this is what this entire season is built around, sign me up, Cam.
This just became the greatest season in Star Trek history.
I'll say this. All the fans back in the day, though, he was called Future Guy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I couldn't remember. That's why I said Shadow Guy, but I was like, that's not right.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe you were thinking of Rocket Girl.
That was a pretty good term, too. I like that. Yeah. And we also got the introduction of Grudge the Cat. So I always think it's fun when they work an animal into Star Trek, although I'm actually surprised they went with a cat considering the horror stories of working with Spot the Cat.
True, but some people just love them caps. Yeah, them.
I mean, they went with a seemingly lazy cat, so maybe that was the key to get one that just looks like he's not going to be that hyperactive.
What did you think of the new opening credits?
I've never been a massive fan of the Discovery opening credits. I thought they were fine. I always enjoy, you know, picking out the new imagery in a given season, but I still just feel like these credits have never landed for me the way that, you know, Enterprise did, you know, minus the song, or the opening credits of the Berman era shows of the original series.
I'm mostly just intrigued by the things that they showcased here. Like they showed off Book's ship. They showed off these new robots with Starfleet Deltas. They showed off new comm badges with like a new ranking system, which is interesting, or at least they showed the ranks differently. And also they showed updated phasers as well. So I was like, okay. But what the hell is Book's weapon at the very start of this where he starts like beating on Burnham? What was that thing?
Okay, we had knives. What did he have before that?
It was like this asp or something, or like some sort of baton. I thought it was supposed to be like an energy weapon he was going to shoot at her, but he kept just like smacking her with it. And I was like, okay.
I at the time when I was watching it, I was debating with myself whether this was a futuristic weapon or a futuristic wrench.
Yeah, it looked like a wrench.
Yeah. All right. So maybe it was just a tool for his ship. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, okay, so overall, we're based on the last 5 minutes, we're excited about where the season goes here. We're excited to get the main characters back, all the rest of the main characters back. What's the next step? What does Star Trek Discovery need to do in episode 2 to make you happy?
Well, you know, circling back to that closing scene with Sahil, I thought that was an incredibly moving sequence of this guy whose life mission has been dedicated to, you know, the Federation and what that could lead going forward. To me, that is everything I look for in, you know, what Star Trek Discovery does best is these moments that feel impassioned and matter, and you completely buy into what the characters want and desire. And so I was 100% on board with that character. And so what does it need to do? It needs to follow that trajectory. I need to see more expansion on, you know, what this guy has been wanting to do and what needs to be done to accomplish that. And I don't really need more phaser fights with random aliens, regardless of how well they were shot and staged.
Kim, I hate to break it to you. There will be more phaser fights with random aliens.
There will be. But, you know, I don't need whole episodes built around characters running around in chase sequences with kind of a great Star Trek-y moment just thrown in the last 10 minutes. Now, this is making me sound very negative on this episode. I enjoyed this episode. I thought it was totally well, you know, it was well made. And I enjoyed being along for the ride of it, but it's not offering me the stuff that I think Discovery does best.
Yeah. One quick question for you, though. Based on the Calypso short trek, it takes place around the same time period as this. We're introduced to Kraft. If that actor was available, do you think he would have been filling the book role in this season?
It seems like it, right?
I would assume so.
Although... Okay, so the character, played by Aldous Hodge in Calypso, he was a soldier, right?
Yes.
Which, here, we don't have any allusions to Book being a soldier.
No, but I think the thing is, if they could have had the actor locked down for this, they would have gone with that story. Like, I think they had to change the character's backstory a bit because they no longer had access to Aldous Hodge, right?
Yeah, I agree. Like, it seems like that would have been the case. Because now, I mean, I'm curious if they pay off Calypso or if it just exists as this kind of... That was a thing, a very entertaining thing, but kind of just dropped.
Well, it's established with, you know, the Discovery having its own AI identity, and it's just adrift with no explanation about where their crew is. I think they're going to have to pay that off somehow.
I agree. So I'm very curious how they work with that. I mean, Aldous Hodge, you know, from Calypso, his career has really blown up. So I guess he's just not really that attainable for them at this point. But I do look forward to them paying off Calypso because I think it raised a lot of interesting mysteries. And the idea of having an AI ship is actually something I'd like to see.
All right. By the way, I just looked it up on Memory Alpha, and then Memory Alpha says that the burn was an event that occurred sometime between the 3060s and the 3080s. So that would mean that the Federation has collapsed within the last 100 years. And Book still doesn't have a clue as to why.
He doesn't read a lot of books.
I'm just saying, okay. Hey, Cam, ever hear of Nazi Germany?
No, what's that? You mean from that Star Trek episode?
No, I'm asking you, Cam Smith.
I'm joking. As in, I only know it from the Star Trek episode. Yes, I'm familiar with Nazi Germany.
Is it still around?
No, it is not.
Why?
I don't know, Tyler. Okay. I don't know.
There you go. Your book.
We will speak about it.
Your new nickname is Book.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. No, the other thing that...
It is weird.
Yeah.
But does it feel like the character... Does it feel like they're writing the character that way to create mysteries, though? That's
the question. Exactly. That's what they do. They just want to create mysteries, and I'm just like, why don't you just spell it out for us? And like, we like, it's fine if you spell it up for us. Like, all these other great series don't hang on mysteries. Like, Kim, you just recently finished Sopranos. I'm in the middle of finishing up season 6. The Sopranos doesn't rest on any mysteries, but you still want to watch an episode after episode after episode. Like, that's kind of what annoys me with regards to their obsession with, like, this mystery box storytelling.
Yeah, or, you know, I think I've also, you know, I've recently been watching Twin Peaks. I've watched the first 2 seasons. And, I mean, at least the first season and a half hinges on a very specific mystery. And the show, that mystery is there throughout the episodes, but it does not depend on the mystery. Like, it goes off in all these different digressions. It doesn't feel like the show is being propelled by the mystery.
When we found out the identity of the Red Angel, what was our reaction?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
That's something.
There you go.
Yeah.
Red Angel, huh? It's Burnham's mom. / Burnham.
Say they, for example, you know, we find out in a handful of episodes, like, the burn, it was caused by the Gorn.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, exactly.
it's annoying that they think this is good writing.
Yeah.
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 Cam, so we've got a bit of a, not a surprise, we did tease it last week, but we are going to do our episode rankings of Star Trek Lower Decks. We had a lot of fun watching season 1. I think we made the argument it's probably the best season 1 of Star Trek since the original series back in 1966-67. Do you want to rank yours from 10 to 1 right now?
Or do you want to go back and forth, or does that just, maybe that's just confusing for people?
It might be a little confusing, but I'll kick it off then. I'll start with number 10.
Okay, you go first.
Yeah, number 10, Moist Vessel. 9, Temporal Edict. 8, Second Contact. 7, Envoys. 6, Terminal Provocations. 5, Much Ado About Boimler. 4, Veritas. 3, Cupid's Errant Arrow. 2, Crisis Point. 1, No Small Parts.
I think it's very telling that our lists are actually fairly similar. There's some digressions, but I will say when I was ranking this list, which I'll read in a second, but it was a real wake-up call that there's no obvious bad episode of this season.
Yeah.
And that Lower Decks, you know, when we talked about Discovery seasons, it was very easy for us to pinpoint what was the worst episode or what was the second worst. Whereas with this show, I'm like, boy, which good episode is the worst?
Yeah, exactly. We're very lucky. And the show also benefits from only having to do 10 half-hour episodes. I get that. Mm-hmm. That's not a luxury that other Star Trek series have enjoyed. But look, I'm fine with that if it means we get like good quality versus just a whole quantity of Star Trek.
That's right. Yeah. So my list was, in last place, I actually had Terminal Provocations. At number 9, I had Envoys. Number 8, Temporal Edict. Number 7, Second Contact. Number 6, Moist Vessel. Number 5, Much Ado About Boimler. Number 4, Crisis Point. Number 3, Veritas. Number 2, Cupid's Errant Arrow. And number 1, No Small Parts.
I think we had just an utterly delightful season. And it is also telling that we have kind of the first half of the season on our lower end of our lists. And then the second half of the season, mm-hmm. they all take the top 5 spots as well. They really kind of got a handle on what makes the show work.
Although, you know, it is noteworthy. I did have Terminal Provocations in last place, which does fall a little bit later in the season than in the first batch.
Well, yeah. Got to do what you got to do. You're not a fan of The Farm, are you?
Well, that's not that episode. Terminal Provocations is the one with Fletcher and Badgie.
No, I'm just saying I'm going to send you to the farm because of your choice.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, fair enough. Sorry. Yeah. Something is obviously malfunctioning.
I like Badgie more than you did, I think.
I enjoy Badgie more as this kind of clunky technology character than as a homicidal lunatic character.
I'm going to get you a Badgie plush doll for your birthday.
Fair enough. And it'll try to kill me in my sleep. And we also had a letter that came in about Lower Decks that I wanted to read. So we had a letter from Mark Aramo, who wrote in to talk about Lower Decks. He says, "Dear Cam and Tyler, it took me 10 episodes to get truly enthusiastic about Lower Decks, but I am finally there. Set aside the fun, obscure references aside, I'm convinced this show is actually hitting upon some problems in the Western world right now. namely institutions with proud traditions and solid track records failing at basic tasks, whether because of calcification, complacency, or mission creep. Maybe we access the story through Boimler, but Mariner is the key to it all. She embodies the spirit of Starfleet and is in active opposition to the letter of Starfleet. The hyper-competitiveness amongst Starfleet personnel that she passively resists is as relevant a commentary on the Western elites of today as any other topic du jour past Star Treks have attempted to tackle, often with two ham fists and a pair of left feet. The obscure references are a lot of fun, but the best moments are when the show spoofs science fiction at large and not Star Trek canon specifically. Example, the Ascension Koala and Tendi's the Dog. Science fiction satire is generally pretty good science fiction itself. Think Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. After all, Star Trek wasn't originally a self-referential homage to itself. It was a platform to bring science fiction stories to television. I hope the writers continue to cast their net wider than just previous Star Trek series. Thanks, Mark. Rhymes with Rom, not a limo, a Romo.
That's a reference to me calling him Gul Dukat a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago when he wrote in before.
Rom is a much more admirable character than Gul Dukat.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
But this is a really good letter, and I really appreciate how he underlines that a lot of people, more early on than later in the season, but were very dismissive of Lower Decks as just making fun of Star Trek, not really doing anything of, you know, real note or merit. And I think this show really did bring a lot to the table in ways even that I think some of the live action Star Treks have struggled to do, which is tackling elements of today in a science fiction setting.
I think we need to keep asking ourselves, like, does the Prime Directive make any sort of sense? And I'm glad that Lower Decks is kind of like putting a lot of these Starfleet ideals that don't necessarily make sense, in front of us. And it is reflective on how I think what happens in institutions, and we're witnessing right now in today's society, is like its momentum carries these things forward, as opposed to us being willing to kind of to break the wheel, to steal a phrase from Game of Thrones, I suppose.
Very true. Yeah. And so I'm really hoping that Lower Decks continues to bring it. And, you know, we did our rankings and, you know, as we said, it was really on fire near the end of the season. So can you imagine if they can start a second season with that same trajectory that they were on going out? This show could be really, really, really special.
I hope it happens soon. Like, we do know that Star Trek Discovery will begin shooting season 4 in Toronto in a few weeks. They're still producing Star Trek Lower Deck season 2. I'm hoping we can get like an official, you know, pickup notice for season 3 sometime soon. So I don't know when we'll get like a Picard or Strange New Worlds, but my guess though is that we'll see Discovery season 4 around this time next year. I don't think we're gonna have to wait another 18 months again, so I wonder then if we can look forward to Lower Decks maybe in summer of 2021. Do you think that kind of makes sense?
I hope so. I think so. I mean, if they had a good head start on the animation, I don't see why not.
And the thing is, animation can keep, you can keep animating even amid a pandemic. Like, I know tons of animators, they've just made that transition into working from home. So,
yeah, I'm really curious when Picard season 2 happens. Not because of any great passion to watch Star Trek season or Star Trek Picard season 2 at this point, but more just in terms of that was a show they really wanted to get on a fast track going off of season 1. And obviously the pandemic has played a big role in stopping that. And I'm wondering when they're going to get going again.
I don't know. I think best case scenario, January, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's tough to say.
Yeah. Yeah. And we also don't know how Strange New Worlds will play into the scheduling as well.
Well, if they have all the sets in like Toronto or something, and it's much easier to film in Canada right now than in the United States, they might fast track that. You know, they might rearrange the schedule, and maybe Strange New Worlds will premiere much sooner than we thought it would. So
yeah, and maybe even Section 31 as well, Tyler.
Yay!
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Obviously, we're doing That Hope Is You, part 2.
Obviously. So come back for that. Okay, you can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in vomiting water, Smith.
And you can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T. T as in tricorder, O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.